Hi, I'm Joe Quirk. I talk to Seasteaders and their supporters. What if you could start your own fantasy government with, say, 100,000 citizens, and you only got two employees? On your little fantasy city, you run government like it's a business that has to please customers. You bring down costs, you create a budget surplus, you win awards, citizen satisfaction rates skyrocket. Your startup city is so successful, other municipalities start imitating it. The model gets copied from Georgia to Japan, and you become the Johnny Appleseed of local government. Oliver Porter actually accomplished this, and we get to hear about this amazing story, which to my mind is a demonstration of what is possible with startup governments. So Oliver Porter is a principal at PPP Associates and author of several books, including The Contract City, and he's become known as the man who outsourced government. Oliver, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure, Joe.
So what spurred your interest in Seasteads?
Well, when I first heard about it, I just thought it was unique, of course, and it is. But having now been involved with local government for a little over 10 years and trying to find better ways to do that, I began to think about Seastead and what a fantastic opportunity it was to actually really innovate in government. You know, in the U.S., we have basically three tiers of government. We have the federal government, state, and then local, which may be sub-tiered and sometimes into county or municipalities, but basically the third tier being the direct provider of local services to the citizens. And that's pretty true of most developed nations around the world. And I began to think about what you're doing and the possibility of eliminating at least two of those three tiers of government that weigh upon the backs of citizens and of businesses. You have the opportunity to in effect create a one-level government with seasteading. Federal, state, and local rolled all into one organization. And that organization, it seems to me, should be serviced by private industry, as have the cities that I've been involved with. Not only should, but I think it may almost be the only way that you could make it function. So you grabbed my attention immediately for seasteading as being the way to achieve something that, of course, I've not been able to do, and that is to bring government down as close to the people as possible and make it as efficient as possible. So very interested in seasteading, and I think it matches up well with the work that I've been doing.
It certainly does. I'm fascinated with what you've accomplished, and I'd love to hear about how did you become involved in local government?
Well, I have had no background in government, had no background whatsoever until a little over 10 years ago. I was asked, well, a little longer than that, to join a committee in our community. It's a community of, at that time, better than 90,000 people here in Georgia that had been trying for almost 30 years to get permission from the Georgia legislature to form a new city. Every state has slightly different laws about how cities may be formed, but in Georgia, cities and counties are direct functions of the state government. They can create them, they can break them, they can change their charters. So you have to go to the state government hat in hand and ask for permission to form a city. Actually, what the bill called for was not even to form it, but to give our citizens the right to have a referendum to vote on whether they wanted to have the city or not. So I went on that committee. After being on a short time, I began to ask what kind of city would we have if we were able to get it through the legislature. And after kicking it around, everyone said, well, we need a charter. And I said, well, if you haven't done that. And they said, no. And I said, well, how do we do that? And they said, well, we need a charter commission. Why don't you form one? So I did, gathered people from around the community, and it was an extremely interesting process of, it was almost, it may sound a bit grandiose, but it was a bit like, writing the original constitution for the country. We had to start from scratch. There had not been a new city formed in Georgia in 50 years at that time. And so there was no blueprint by which we could go to follow to form a city. So we began right back with the basics of, you know, what kind of government are we going to have? What will be its authority, and what will be its limitations, and wrote a charter. Several years went by, and we still did not get the city through the legislature. And then finally in 2002, I guess it was, there was a change of party, political party at the both the governor and the Senate went to a new party, and we got excited that we might have a city. And at that point, I said, well, we do have a charter, but how are we actually going to implement this thing? And no one really had any idea. Everyone had been so focused on just driving hard to get it through the legislature. So I went home for a meeting and literally took out a pad of paper and began to create flow charts and PERT charts and critical paths and all that of how you should form a city. Took it back into the committee, and they approved it, and then nothing happened that year. 2 years later, we finally got a change in the House of Representatives, which is the body that had been blocking us all that time. And the new rulers of the House said, your bill is going to be bill number one. So all of a sudden, it looked like we were going to have a city in a matter of months. And we didn't have a real plan. And everyone says, well, where's that plan you did? And I said, well, I have it. And they said, well, would you implement it? And I said, well, on two conditions. One, I need a title because I'm talking to other cities and they won't give me the time of day, but maybe if you call me interim city manager, they will. And in fact, that did work. And the second was, we have no time to do this. We can't do it by committee. You need to give me some authority to really go about starting the city in this short period of time. So the way I became the city manager without pay, of course, for this new city of almost 100,000 people.
That's hilarious. You can hear Alex almost spitting up his coffee to hear this. I mean, you started as a volunteer, no experience in government, and then all of a sudden this falls into your lap. And then you write a charter on a yellow pad. And where did you go from there? Like
At that point, I started in the way you might expect. I formed 12 task forces of citizen volunteers from the community to address the 12 areas of service that I had outlined on my pad as being needed. And thought we would put them to work. Basically, I charged them with four charges. One, find out what level of service the county is now providing in your area, your charge area. Second, to the best of your ability, find out what that's costing, and that was a very difficult thing to find out in the county. Third, decide what it is we really want and need as a community. And fourth, what do we think that would cost? And when we get all those numbers together, I'll build a budget. So my committees began working diligently. We were fortunate to have some very, very talented and determined people working on things. I think the committee's task forces numbered about 120 people at the peak, and they did some fine work. But from the beginning, I was pretty aware that we couldn't follow the traditional city model, which is to have your own employees and your own equipment and your own buildings and all those things, because the bill that was passed, unfortunately, gave no one any authority. We couldn't hire anyone. We couldn't buy anything, lease anything, make contracts, anything, until the moment the city was actually to be incorporated. And at that moment, it had to be fully operational. So as you can see, that's an almost insurmountable obstacle. So I began to look for alternatives. And I suppose it was my corporate background that in part took me in that direction. But I felt that large corporations, if they wanted to, could do this thing, could provide all the services for the city. And I took it upon myself to write 24 letters, or one letter to 24 sources, writing to CEOs and presidents of major companies and saying, where have you done this, any of these services? And the second question is, would you be willing to spend the resources and money that would be necessary to start the city without a contract? Because I can't give you a contract. I have no authority to. The interesting enough, 12 of the 24 actually responded, citing places where they had done one service or another, but none of them doing the full array of services by even close to that. Mm-hmm. And the second question was totally dodged. The best I got was, we could discuss this or talk about it, that being the matter of doing it without a contract. And I took that as a yes, though, and went ahead and went down to my basement office and began to write RFPs, requests for proposals, to send out to get bids from these companies on actually providing all the services of the city.
So you write a constitution, you call corporations, and then you just start bidding out things like road maintenance and traffic lights, and like how did all that work?
Yeah, basically the 12 areas I had identified, I might run those down quickly. Basic administration, accounting, finance. A big one was IT, providing IT systems for us. The one area we did not intend to do by private industry was public safety, that being police, fire, and our courts. But even there, we wrote into the request that the company would do the backroom operations for those functions, that being record keeping and paperwork and so forth. So even in public safety, a part of it is done by private industry.
In Sandy Springs, I called 911. Did you find some way to reduce costs on that? Or?
Oh, yeah. I do want to talk about that, but let me finish outlining the broad area of services.
Right.
In addition to the ones I've spoken about, we had, of course, parks and recreation to be done. Mm-hmm. We had what we call community development, which is planning, zoning, permitting, code enforcement. And we had transportation, which covers not only the provision and maintenance of roads, but also your traffic signals and the traffic patterns, control of traffic design within the city. So all of those areas, it's a pretty broad spectrum of services. One of those, and a smaller one, was the provision of 911 services, emergency services. The county had a terrible reputation in that regard. Mm-hmm. We bid that out initially just to serve us, but we have subsequently been able to now offer that service to nearby cities, and we now have four cities that are sharing the cost, which has cut our cost by, it was already well below what the county was charging us, but cut our cost then by about two-thirds from the initial where we were paying for the service entirely, while giving much, much more modern and upgraded service. One of the things we were particularly interested in was not having our citizens call in and get a menu of numbers to push and this sort of thing, and mm-hmm. eventually not getting any answer. We have a company set up a system that gives 24-hour-a-day service, 7 days a week. You get a live citizen when you call, a live answer when you call into Sandy Springs. And not only do you get a live person answering, the system lets them then decide what department this needs to go to if they can't answer the question. And if it requires some work, they actually initiate the work order right there when they're on the phone with the person. That goes to the department, and it also goes to the mayor and the appropriate city council person for that area. We have a commitment to respond within 2 days on those calls. And if it's a kind of an emergency that someone's cutting down trees on the lot next door or something, it's a two-hour response. And when the work is completed, the system then gives a response to the citizen and also gives a response to the mayor, the appropriate council person, the city manager, everyone who should be in the loop to know that this work has been has been scheduled and done is done. So it's a beautiful system that they provided under the contract.
And so you increased the efficiency of this and dropped it to a quarter of the cost by bidding out like 911 services. Am I understanding?
Yeah, overall, we're seeing cost cuts in the range of 10 to 40% in various cities. And that range is there because some were more efficient to start with than others, but in no case have I ever seen one where the traditional model could come close to matching the efficiency of the contract model that we have installed.
And you have all these cost-sharing savings. One of my favorite examples is that Sandy Springs has no jails. So how does that work?
Yeah.
What if there's a criminal that you have to catch?
Right. We initially said, well, we don't want to have to own and maintain buildings. So we began to look to other communities, counties, cities. It didn't matter if they had spare capacity in their jails. We went to them and said, you want to rent that out? Well, it was a good deal for them as well as us. If they were sitting there with a good bit of spare capacity, they were paying for all of it and not using it, and they were able to then pull in revenue from us, and we were able to get a price far below that which it would have cost us if we had to build our own facility. There are many cost-sharing elements here. The favorite one that I talk about, because everyone understands it, is potholes, mm-hmm. holes in your road. Almost every community has problems with those and getting them fixed.
Mine does.
When we were with the county, if you ever got them to come out, they would send about 8 people, and 7 of them would stand around talking while one used a shovel, maybe. Now what you see in our cities is that you'll see a 2-man crew, and they'll have on a shirt that says Sandy Springs, and they'll have a truck with a magnetic sign that says Sandy Springs. They do the work, and they're gone. Tomorrow, that same 2-man crew and truck might be in one of other nearby cities with their logo on the shirt and the truck and doing work there. And then the real beauty of it is on the third day, that same group and truck might be on a private parking lot fixing potholes there. So there's no downtime. You have full utilization of the people. You have full utilization of equipment. And we, by the way, own no equipment. It's all provided under contract, which means we don't have to have maintenance sheds, warehouses, any of the capital costly things that might go along with maintaining a fleet of trucks. And we have no downtime. It's just extremely efficient.
And didn't a private company like make roads using a laser or something? Can you tell me about the roads?
I'm sorry, repeat that.
Tell me about the roads and how those relate and how you made money. I think you laid a lot more roads than had previously been laid through a private company.
In the first years, we have surfaced 175 miles of road. In the previous 25 years, the county had done about 10. I'll give you an order of magnitude of how much improved the situation is. Equivalent sidewalks to go with those. We've also acquired significant park acreage. Our county was shorting us so badly that we had 1 acre of park for every 11 acres that were in other parts of the county. Well, we now have brought ourselves up to par there and have created a lot of very nice new parks. Some of them have won national awards, in fact,
yeah,
for their design and usability. All of the recreation programs in those parks are under contract, and it's we were able to pay for those new parks with the savings that we have gotten from operations all across the board.
Yeah, and you promised not to raise taxes, and you never did.
Right. We went in initially with a promise on that. We began with a carve-out, if you would, of the revenues that the county was getting from our properties. And we have not increased the millage rate 1 mil in that time, no increase. Overall, while not increasing taxes, and right through, by the way, if you think about 10 years, it was right through the biggest portion of the recession that the country faced, when mm-hmm. so many cities were counties were having real financial problems. We went right through that with no tax increase, actually built up a reserve from zero to $40 million, applied 20% of our operating budgets to capital improvements such as roads and parks, sidewalks, things that require significant money and usually require borrowing to be able to do many of those things. And coming out the other end of all that, we had zero long-term debt or liabilities, unpaid liabilities for pensions and other benefits. And it's that last thing that has just been an albatross on the back of so many. If you've seen a city go bankrupt, it's because of their unpaid liabilities for pensions and benefits. So we've been able to avoid all of that, and we're simply not going to have those.
It's really, so zero debt, zero liabilities, and you built a surplus straight through the recession without raising taxes. And you consider, you know, what you said before, you paving 170 miles of roads in 1 year when the whole county did, what, 10 miles in 25 years?
That was 170 something miles in a period of about 5 years, actually.
Oh, okay.
And all the years preceding hadn't even approached that.
That's amazing. So how did your transfer of services, how is that different from what people call privatization?
Well, I differentiate between what we're doing, which I call either a public-private partnership or just contract city. It differs from the traditional model in a number of ways, but primarily, it is simply differs in that instead of having to have employees on the payroll, which often you don't need them for sometimes, if you have peak periods, for instance, of work, you have to hire enough people to do the peak, and then the off-peak, you have surplus people, which you can't get rid of. With the contract city, that never occurs. They bring in the people that they need during peaks, and then when you don't need them, they're not there. A good example of that was at the very beginning. We had planned on processing a certain number of building permits monthly, and we had forced up for that. Well, at the very last minute, the county dumped 800 unprocessed permits on us, for which, by the way, they had already accepted the money from the applicant, but they had not processed them. And here we were as a brand new city day one with 800, and we'd been planning on having about 50 a month. So you could see what a peak that was. Well, the company simply had to bring in the people to do it. But when they were done, they were gone. They came from other parts of their business, other areas of the country, even maybe some internationally. The real beauty to this is that this concept of them being able to bring in what you need not only extends to manpower, but it also extends to technical capability. I'm sure you can imagine that setting up the IT for a new city was a tremendous undertaking, and it required a great deal of expertise that you probably on a day-to-day basis don't need. But they were able to bring in from around the world, again, people with the right expertise to do this thing and do it right. And then when in a matter of 60, 90 days, when we were satisfied that everything was running smoothly, those people were gone. And we didn't have to pay anything extra. It was all under the contract.
So what in general happens to the government employees?
To the government that had been there?
Yeah, if that's a relevant question.
The county? Yeah, well, we are still part of that county. We didn't secede. We just pulled off the provision of local services from the county. Almost all of them. What is left with the county that they're still responsible for is a sheriff's department. We have our own police department. They have a sheriff's department. A level of courts. We have the municipal courts, and they have the next level of courts. They handle the major criminal activities. And then Oh, in the libraries, and we only have one library, which we should have more, but they only provided us one, and they're still responsible for that. But the biggest part of the expense that they kept was in the area of health and welfare type services. And I wish we had taken those, but that may be something for down the road. So we took only 15% of the property tax revenue, leaving the county with 85% of it. And we're able to do all those services I listed with that 15% and do it quite efficiently and successfully. To be fair to the county, though, of their 85%, 52% of it goes into the school system, which is a separate, in our case, a separate organization from the county.
And like for contract cities, the services improve, they get cheaper. And you're making me think, you know, this morning I went out to bring my garbage and recycling cans back inside, and the waste collectors often like spill stuff all over the street, which we have to clean up and put right back in the bins they emptied. And they often drop the bins on the street where people park, and they often put them in our driveway. And my wife and I always get this feeling of contempt from the garbage collectors and the street sweepers in our city. And it makes me ask, like, what's going on? Like, why is the service so poor?
Well, the way we addressed garbage collection, for instance, was actually the county had been fairly good in that they didn't provide that. They allowed private companies to provide the garbage collection already. And in our area, we had five such companies across the full range of the city doing that. And rather than try to bring that directly under city control, I decided to franchise the garbage collection, which would allow people to keep the collector that they already had if they wanted to, or shop around for a different one. Mm-hmm. The reaction to that has been pretty good. It did leave us with more collectors maybe than we would like to have, but it allowed two things. One, we collect 5% of their revenue into the city's coffers, and it also gives us the ability to regulate their service, whereas before no one was doing that. We now have standards for their service, and we're able to say to a company, if it's not meeting those standards, you're going to lose your franchise. Mm-hmm. And so it's worked out pretty well. In some instances in the city, say a large subdivision, they have gone in and negotiated to have only one company pick up in the area and get reduced rates for in effect giving a sub franchise, and that's fine. That's a free economy to do that, I think. So we have a number of, I guess, novel sort of solutions to how to address different areas of service. It's not a cookie cutter like the county was. You either took the county service or you had no service. We have some options for people.
So where has the contract city model been used?
Unfortunately, it has not caught on and spread to existing cities in the way I have hoped it would. We have six new cities in Georgia that are actually using it. I have had the opportunity to go to a number of other cities in the country and, in fact, around the world and study them. And in every case, we've been able to show that the existing city could convert to this model and save, again, 10 to 40% of their operating costs if they were to do so. And you'd think that people would jump on that, but there's only one problem, and it's a thing called politics. When you have an existing county commissioner or city council person that got elected under the old system, they are extremely reluctant to take a chance on anything new, no matter how good it might seem, and run into that wall. That I don't give them a lot of credit for that attitude. Yeah. The other opposition comes from the existing employee base. And I think I can understand that and have a little more sympathy. It scares an employee. They've been basically have tenure. It's almost impossible to fire them. You know, you can't discipline them, and you really can't even motivate them under the existing systems. But they're there, and they're safe there, and so they're scared that something's going to happen to them.
And this is an example of how you can get outside existing systems and start over again, which you've done six times in how many years?
In the last 10.
Some of your remarks struck me as like, you know, maybe there's some interesting background there. Who are you getting, like, you know, for contract cities, who's the folks coming to you with the most interest? Is it like private citizens? Is it, you know, people who want better government? Is it the city administrators who are overwhelmed? Like, who do you see coming to you with these things?
I have had some of all of those, Alex, but it normally right now seems to be groups that have been formed, like tax reform groups, better government groups, civic groups. They come, it's not the city officials so much, unfortunately. You wish it were. But I have had some mayors and council people come. But right now I'm hearing more from groups that are activists, I suppose, in their communities looking for better things than their existing government officials are willing to look into.
Is that kind of how you guys started in Sandy Springs? Like a bunch of unincorporated citizens and, well, we want a really good, effective system for administering all of these services that we want, but we don't think we'll get it with conventional local government?
It was actually, as I had said, you know, a tremendous long fight politically, driven by a lady, a PhD in economics, who's an activist in the community and was just a bulldog. She just wouldn't give up on it. So that's politically what drove it. But the model, the contract cities model, actually was simply, it really just came out of me and out of a inability to figure out a way to start a traditional government with no authority and to have it fully operational the minute after the city started. Without having been able to find any way to hire people and set it up before that. Mm-hmm. And as I said, since my career had been in the corporate world, in large corporation, I was very cognizant of what a big company can do when it wants to and sure. the kind of resource it can bring to bear. And so that's when I, on my own, went out and began to solicit companies to say, can you do this for us? And when they gave me enough of encouragement that they probably could, then I went to the drawing board and created the RFPs and took it through the whole process. One of the things I didn't talk about, and I think maybe I told Joe in passing before, was that part of the bill created a call for the governor to appoint a commission to assist the city in its formation. But unfortunately, it gave that commission no power either, no authority. And he appointed, as politicians do, four people who had nothing to do with the creation of the city, hadn't worked on the committee, and two of them didn't even live in our community. And the fifth person was myself. Mm-hmm. And they, because none of them even knew what was going on, decided to elect me chairman, which put me in the enviable position of presenting things as city manager to myself as chairman of the governor's commission. That really smoothed things out a lot. So that was a mechanism that every city wouldn't have necessarily, but in our state, these governor's commissions have been there with supposedly to assist, but really doing nothing but getting in the way if they weren't handled right. So yeah, the whole concept of doing it with private industry was sort of my idea, and I carried it through because I really didn't know how to do it else. It's better to be lucky than smart sometimes. And I think that was the case here.
Why don't more cities do it this way? Everybody saves money. It seems like a giant win. You know, what are the perverse incentives that you see keeping people from serving their citizens like this?
It's just two things. It's politics and the unwillingness of existing elected officials to take a chance on something different, one. And two, the pressure that existing employee bases bring to not change because they're fearful for their jobs. They shouldn't be, because what has proven to be true is that about 90% of them will be retained. It's only the real deadwood which will go and should go, but they will be retained. They will have better compensation, and they will have better training, and they will clearly have better morale than people who are willing to listen to them. So if they could somehow be able to suddenly jump a year in the future and see what their lives would be like, most of them would be very happy to have the change. But those people who are not producing, of course, are scared for their jobs, and they should be if they're not producing. But it's those two factors, just the inertia of politics and the employee base are the holdups. And like I said, if we could ever break through and get a few of those that are actually working or in place, I think it could really begin to spread like crazy.
What's the involvement of the state or the federal government like in the creation of these towns? Do they have any interest? Are they totally disinterested? Is it mostly working with, you know, the county and the state governor?
Yeah, the federal government has no involvement. The state government, and it varies by state. For instance, you can form a new city in Texas and you can get a petition signed by 25 people, whereas in Georgia, you've got this very laborious legislative process to go through. You've got to get basically a bill passed in the House and the Senate and then signed by the governor. Mm-hmm. And it can be quite difficult at times. So state governments in varying degrees will be involved. The counties out of which you are being carved almost universally oppose it because, right, once again, it's cutting into their domain. So you can count on not getting a lot of help from your county. But as I said, I've also been trying to convert counties, whole counties, because in rural areas, the county is the server of last resort. So this is just as applicable to a county as it is a city, and can show the same kinds of savings in the county. I studied a county up in Maryland, and we got about in excess of 25% savings there, and they voted it down. We did two larger cities in Texas. In one, there were savings of up to $160 million over the life of a five-year contract. And the other, the savings went up to about $65 million, smaller city. And we still haven't been able to get that passed through their ruling bodies. So it's not an easy thing to do. People, you know, there's obviously a lot of disbelief. Well, you can't really make that happen, but you can. And as I said, in this little county in Georgia, we went all the way through to the point where it was a fact. I mean, here is your existing budget and here is your contract. It's a 25% savings for you. And they still voted it down. So,
right.
It's human nature is a difficult thing to deal with, and politicians are a particular form of human nature that's kind of difficult to deal with, as you probably mm-hmm. know. Still out there trying to tell the story.
I heard you were so successful, you were presented with a mechanical pig. Is that story true? Something about flying pigs or something?
Yeah, that's been a joke in the city from the beginning. One of the senators who opposed very strongly the formation of the cities speaking in the well of the Senate said, Sandy Springs will become a city when pigs fly. So the evening that we had the governor come out to sign the bill, people had come up with a number of flying pigs. Some of them were wind up with little flapping wings and so forth. So I have a collection of flying pigs now, and the mayor had a collection of them also. Sort of a gotcha thing.
Yeah, what a great honor.
Yeah.
And now today I've heard there was some ranking where out of like more than 10,000 municipalities, Sandy Springs was ranked what?
Well, we've had in every survey that has been conducted, either internally here or national surveys we participated in, Sandy Springs from a, if you want to call it customer satisfaction, citizen satisfaction, has ranked in the top 10%. In almost universally. Our people really do enjoy the benefits they're getting. And by the way, most people, I would say if you went out and polled them, most people don't even know that the employees that they're dealing with are not employees of the city. They just assume they are. The only thing that they see different, however, is so much better morale and treatment coming from those people than they traditionally get. They sort of step back and say, wow, how's this happening? And then they may find out, well, these are not city employees. These are people working in private industry, and they have to perform. Mm-hmm. I might add, I said, you know, that it's natural that people be reluctant to change the system if they are employees, but they, most of them are so much better off under the contract system. Their morale is particularly better. So many of them have said to me, you know, I worked in government for years, and I tried to tell people how we could do my job more efficiently, and nobody wanted to even hear it until I just learned not to bring it up anymore. Became complacent. When they come to these private company jobs, the company welcomes their ideas with open arms, because guess what? The company has a profit motive. And when they can get more efficient, they can make more money out of it. And they reward their employees for doing that. And so the level of morale amongst employees versus traditional government employees is tremendous. And the public recognizes that, even if they don't even know why. They may not, as I said, know they're even company employees, but they can see the difference, and it's reflected in the service they get.
There's, I guess, resistance from counties and existing municipal governments and existing power structures against giving up any of their prerogatives to this new system. But do you see, you know, any interest from administrators or from communities in their current civil administration adopting techniques or tools from the Sandy Springs system and moving existing cities in the direction of contract cities?
Yeah, there's interest. We just haven't been able to get it to become a majority interest.
Mm-hmm. Right, because you're naturally fighting uphill against the existing contractors for the city, or against, you know, their existing trash service or whatever it is.
Yeah. And like I said, I'll get a call from a council person, sometimes a mayor, sometimes a city manager or a county manager, who think, you know, this sounds like something we ought to be looking into. But when it comes down to finally getting the political muscle to make it happen, people get cold feet.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And you mentioned there had to be years and years and years of turnover of specific personnel in Georgia to make this a reality.
Well, I didn't want to get into one party versus another, but Georgia had been a Democrat-controlled state for, you know, forever. Mm-hmm. The Republicans finally got the Senate and the governorship in 2002, but the Speaker of the House is a very powerful position in Georgia, some think stronger than the governor even, and the Speaker had said that, you know, it would be over his dead body. Fortunately, we were able to get him out of there and then as the Republicans took over the House in 2004, and that's when they said, your bill is bill number one. And then we just had a matter of months to actually create the city.
It strikes me as a remarkably strange system where 100,000 people can get together and say, we want to run our lives like this. And one individual, you know, in the Capitol can be, you know, the obstacle that stands in your way and saying, absolutely not, I will not let you run your lives this way.
Well, it's happening every day, everywhere. We're, you know, it's nothing novel about it. It's disgusting, but it's nothing novel about it. And we just had a lady here who just was never going to take no for an answer. And she organized the community and kept after it, just wouldn't give up until we finally made it happen. Mm-hmm. Then the next year, two new cities formed, and the next year, another one formed, and then we skipped a year and another one formed. So we broke the ice. Mm-hmm. People, and obviously those cities would not have been formed and would not have followed this model if it were not clearly a winner. I mean, that's the proof of the pudding. And there have been no new cities formed that have attempted to adopt the traditional model. This is just head and shoulders better.
And all of these new cities are in Georgia? Or are you getting some like further afield, like you mentioned, several in Texas? Did anything take off in Japan?
We were very close to doing a city of about 50,000 in Japan when the tsunami hit. The government's just basically, it didn't hit that city, but all resources were turned towards the recovery effort. stopping anything from going forward like that. And then the mayor, who had been the champion of doing this, lost his election. And that was the end of that. So, no, we didn't get one going in Japan, but there is a pretty strong movement there still in place, mainly driven through the university in Toyo University in Tokyo. I met with their board and chairman and so forth. Interesting enough, Japan does not have any such creature as a city manager. They run their governments with only, you know, I mentioned you have your elected officials, your administrator, and then your workforce. Well, they have only two tiers. They have their elected officials and their workforce. They have no professional management in between. And they have these enormous city councils who try to run the city. And they're horrible. Mm-hmm. So I met with the leadership of the university and said, you know, you guys need to inject into society here the concept of a professional city manager. So they've begun a curriculum, hopefully will become an advanced degree curriculum to actually train people to be city managers, and they've begun to place them out in the municipalities. And so I think over time that may take root, but it's desperately needed. I know this city of 50,000 had 23 councilmen who basically divided up the processes. And you can imagine, I looked at their sewer and water system. They had 25 treatment plants, a city of 50,000, 25 treatment plants. They needed one.
Oh,
and
my.
I asked them, how did that happen? And they said, well, you know, it was recommended to us. And I said, well, who did your feasibility studies? They said, the vendors. And that explains why they now have 25 and they need one, because people sold them, the goods. They had no professional management who was capable of evaluating the recommendations that the vendors were giving them. And that sort of thing just goes, what was Osaka? I went, I was supposed to meet with the mayor, and he said where he was in an emergency meeting with the council. I said, by the way, how many council do you have? It's 76. So it's a system that could stand some revamping on the elected official level as well as the worker bee level.
Do the taxpayers, they're paying 25 times as much as they would otherwise?
Well, it may not be a multiple of 25, but it's certainly probably 5 to 10 times for that specific water sewer system as they should be. Jeez. None of those plants were running at more than 25% capacity. And I swear they were so close together, I could almost throw a rock from one to the other. So you run into those things, and, you know, no system's perfect, but they desperately need some professional management, and they need to cut down on the numbers of elected officials and, you know, get things straightened out there, and I hope they will. But they had been, their system had allowed the cities to draw upon basically have a drawing account on the federal government. So every year they just borrowed more money from the federal government and went deeper and deeper in debt.
Right. The government's removed the difficulties attendant with a city, you know, receiving loans. They just go to the government and the government asks for money from elsewhere.
But now their federal government's not in that great a shape. So it actually was the federal government that got me involved. They gave a grant to Toyo University to study what could be done. And Toyo found Sandy Springs, came over, met with them, and asked me to come over there. And that's where I got involved with Japan, was through the, not a grant to myself, but a grant to Toyo.
It's interesting that they would feel that much pressure coming from the municipalities borrowing funds, that the federal government goes out looking for help.
Yeah. Well, when you take, you know, that many cities, and some of them, you know, Tokyo and some of those others are enormous cities. When you take that many cities all drawing on you, it's not an insignificant amount of money. It's major. And their federal government just wasn't able to do that any longer, isn't it? They're trying to cut the umbilical cord a little bit.
And what is the potential market for contract cities?
I have estimated it in the U.S. at about $90 billion. I think that's very conservative.
Yeah, because Japan independently estimated like $110 billion market for contract cities.
Yeah, they did. they did when I was working with them. They came up with that, and they need it desperately, by the way. Their debt problems even dwarf ours. In Japan, I found out that of the 1,800 and something municipalities, their average debt to operating income ratio is 25%. In other words, for every $4 they take in, one is going to pay nothing but the interest on debt. Oof. Not repay, but just the interest. So they're in bad trouble, and they need to do something to improve their efficiency. But we have enough problems of our own in that regard. And it is a far more efficient and effective way. I have often said that my criteria for success, when people say, well, you say these cities are success, well, how do you measure that? Basically in two simple ways. One, I believe in bringing government as close to the people as possible, and forming these new cities has done that. And two, of course, is simply being efficient when you do it. So we have involved our citizens in the process now. They have access to government that they never had before, and they have extremely efficient services being rendered to them.
And Contract Cities, the book, has become Contract Cities, the business, hasn't it?
I'm sorry. Once again, I have a little hearing problem.
Oh, it's okay. Contract Cities, the book, has become Contract Cities, the business. Like, you've started a business called Contract Cities. Is that correct?
Yeah. I'm trying to spread the knowledge of this around the world, it's a fairly daunting task, but I can't do much about the problems of our federal government or our state government, but I think I can have some impact on local government. And if we can begin to get enough existing cities to bite the bullet and go ahead and take advantage of these opportunities, these savings, then I think that the wall comes down and it will spread like wildfire. But it is difficult. I studied a county here in Georgia. I did more than study, actually wrote the RFPs for them and helped them through the contract selection process last year. It was a very poor county in terms of its resources and not very developed, and I really wasn't sure that it would be a big enough contract to even attract a company to come in. But at the end, after we had put out the RFPs, we had seven companies bid. In the selection process, we got a very, very good company, and they guaranteed, and when I say guaranteed, I mean taking the existing county budget, they guaranteed to cut their costs by 25% under contract.
Wow.
So there was no funny thing, money there. It was all real. Cut it by 25%, and those commissioners voted it down 4-3. So,
there you
that
go.
Political thing is very difficult. I might add, though, that the swing vote is now in jail, not for this vote, but for other reasons. So maybe there's some hope coming that we'll get a more reasonable person in there that would be interested in actually saving money for their citizens. I often hear, I'm mostly worried about our employees. And I point out, and it's not always well accepted, but that your responsibility is not to the employees. It is to the citizens who elect and pay your salary. And if they will do that mind shift there to really start considering their citizens as number one priority, I think we will have made a good step in terms of getting them to look for a better way. You know, we've been doing local government in this country the same way for 100 years. Nothing else is like it was 100 years ago. I mean, we've got people on the moon, we've got computers, we've got airplanes, we've got, you know, it's a different world. And yet we're still doing local government the way we always did. And it's time to change. You guys are trying to make an enormous change. I think that this type of government service fits beautifully with that. It basically would replace, as I said, all three levels, a federal, a state, and a local government with the minimal government needed to government services needed to serve your cities, your seasteading cities. It's a match made in heaven, actually.
So you think the contract cities model will work on a seastead?
Absolutely. I can't see how anything else would work.
Yeah.
If you're going to have a floating city, are you going to import people to fix roads or do all the other services? I don't think that's needed. Hire a company to do it, and they'll bring in what you need, and it'll be well trained, and you'll have an efficient operation.
Yeah, I mean, you were a naval officer on a government ship, and years later, your wife got you to go on a cruise ship. And is a cruise ship like a contract city?
Yeah, in so many ways, it is. It provides all the necessary services for your day-to-day life there. The governance of it is a little different from a city. And I want to come back to that governance in a second. But yes, it's a very efficient way of providing living for people. The major difference might be that I guess you foresee in a seastead city that you're going to have businesses there that are providing services and products outside of the city, whereas a cruise ship its business is providing for the people aboard there.
Mm-hmm.
But other than the development of a business aspect to it, it would be just like a cruise ship, and hopefully as much as efficient and as much fun.
Right. That's what I hope to see. And
let me mention, just in case someone is interested, one of the concerns people often have about the contract cities is a knee-jerk reaction, well, some big company is going to be running the city. And that's not what we've done. You still have your traditional three levels of government, one being the elected officials, and they set policy, budget, all of those things. An administrative level, a city manager, maybe a county manager, who then administers that policy. And then all the rest of the workforce, that third tier, is what we're replacing with a private company. So all of the control, if you want to, of the city, the setting of policy and budgets is still in the hands of the elected officials. And the administration of the contract is still in the hands of a person that they hire. And then you have this efficient workforce. Is the change that takes place. So it's not a giving up of any citizens' control. In fact, it's more control than ever for the citizens because it's now heard in a relatively smaller government.
So I did want
to get that in because that's one of the things that people often throw up in the beginning as a concern that some big company is taking over the city.
And you've written a bunch of books on the subject. Could you give us information on those publications?
Yeah, thanks for asking. I originally had no intention of writing a book. I'm an engineer by undergraduate degree and not a journalist, so I didn't start out to write a book. What I was doing, I was advising these other new cities. I was a principal advisor for six cities that have come along. And I started putting down notes to give them about how to do things, and it just grew, and soon the volume was such that I said, my goodness, this really could be a book. So the first book is called Creating the New City of Sandy Springs, and it basically retells the story of how we went about doing it, but the whole second half of it are usable items like the charter, the RFPs, the contracts, the legislation, and of course that would have to be tailored to whatever state you're in. It's basically a how to do it book. Then after I had done that, and it was basically about new cities, I had a number of communities asking, well, could we do this in an existing city? So I wrote a second book called Public-Private Partnerships for Local Governments. And that one has to do with sort of the results of the initial cities and also has, as appendices to it, much of the same information, RFPs, contracts, and so forth that the other one did, so the new cities can also see that. An interesting thing, when I was working, speaking in Japan and working with the city there, they decided they wanted the books in Japanese, so one of the universities there translated them, put two of them into both books into one book, which is because of the efficiency of their written language is much smaller than either of the two original books. And they published them in Japan, and they were extremely well received over there. And
it was a top 10 nonfiction bestseller in Japan, wasn't it?
Yeah. The second month, it hit the top 10 list for their nonfiction government genre books. And I was floored because, as I said, I never thought I would be an author. And I had laughingly said to my family to put on my tombstone that I'm an international best-selling author now.
As an author, that makes me jealous. That would be like me building a bridge and it wins an award.
The last book that might be interesting to people, excuse my cough, is an e-book just entitled The Contract Cities. Mm-hmm. And it's a much abbreviated version of the others. And all of them are available through Amazon or the written books. You can go to the publisher, Author House, put in my name or title and get them. But they have been interesting. There continues to be interest in them. I get a quarterly report from them, and I'm always surprised that people are still buying them. But anyone who's interested in starting a city or converting a city should maybe begin there and then go from that point.
I hope that, if we get our floating city project going or get a seastead going, that we can just take your how-to book and hand it over to our administrators and our lawyers and just get our city going following the techniques you pioneered. Because if these cities can proliferate in Georgia and in Japan, they can certainly work elsewhere. So it's marvelous.
Oh, yeah. I've had interest in a number of countries. I guess the most recent contact was in Mongolia. I actually had to go to the internet and look up where the capital city of Mongolia was. But just before that, I heard from folks in the Ukraine, and I had to tell them I'd be glad to advise them, but I wasn't coming there right now. That's the safest place in the world. But, you know, Honduras and Ireland, Malaysia,
Jesus.
Different places that contacts that have expressed a lot of interest in doing it, and all of them have a different sets of problems and different governmental systems to deal with. But all in all, when you get down to it, everyone has some form of local government that's the direct interface with the citizens, and in many ways, that's the most important government we have to deal with because it's the one that affects our day-to-day lives, and so we can make tremendous strides in terms of improving the service under those systems.
And it makes me think about the potential of seasteading and free cities because you got this marvelous opportunity where you had this opportunity to make a little startup town and you ran it like a business and it was so much more successful. And it makes me think about all the other people out there that could start again. And it amazes me to hear about all these people from different countries who've heard about contract cities and contacted you and asked you for your counsel. So, I hope we can implement your techniques on the ocean someday.
Well, it's a perfect match for you, and I'm not sure how you do it otherwise. It just makes sense. And again, you are bringing forth the opportunity to basically combine the national government, the state or whatever it's called in other countries, departments or whatever, regional governments, national, regional government, and local government into one, under one umbrella that's close to the people involved. That's getting close to utopia, I think. I had a good old Southern friend who always said, if you're making a talk, you have to use some big words like warehouse, dump truck, things of that nature. And so I would say my big word for this little talk is that you can approach utopia asymptotically.
I think it will speed up and maybe we'll never get to Bluetopia, as I like to call it, but we can certainly, if we can provide the kind of startups that we have in technology in governance itself, we can exponentially increase the rate at which things improve and get more efficient, which I think you've already started. So I'm glad you're setting the precedent, and I hope to implement your policies and your techniques and your outsourcing on a seastead someday.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for talking to us.
You know, it may seem a little far afield from seasteading, but it really isn't. Eventually, you guys are going to, if you get this thing to float, you're going to have some form of governance, some form, some way of supplying services to the to people who are there. And this is a natural for it.
Yep.
It's nice, too, to have an example you can point to and say, see, you have a greater extent of private governance. You have, you know, you don't have this, this monolithic Leviathan state managing everything, and it doesn't turn into, you know, a post-apocalypse or like a RoboCop type scenario. It actually works, and it, it saves people money, and, you know, people want it.
And if people are really interested, we can send them to this podcast. It's immensely relevant to seasteading.
Well, I have recommended it for cities from in a range of 10,000 to a quarter of a million. When it gets when you get smaller than that, and I'm talking about, you know, traditional land-based cities, you probably don't have a big enough contract to really attract a company unless there are multiple opportunities in that area. If you get bigger than 250,000, it begins to, you have such a bureaucracy to deal with trying to convert it. It's not that you couldn't do it, but the conversion of it becomes a bit messy. So I have been focusing on those areas. Now, your seastead cities would probably be smaller than that initially, but they are a very special case, and they should grow up with this type of government, I think. Well, I have great admiration for what you guys are doing with, and I understand the problem of limited resources very, very well. That's been one of the things I have, of course, dealt with in trying to tell this story. But very much admire what you're doing, and hope that it will be a great success. And if I can be a any part of making it so, I'd like to.
Yeah, Randy sometimes mentions we got to get Oliver Porter on our floating city project, so we do it right straight out of the gate. So, it you know, it gives me a lot of encouragement that what you've already accomplished. So, the more of these we can create, the better.
Well, I'm you know, this is not a job for me full time or anything like that. Although there were times when I spent. When I was first doing Sandy Springs, I guess I was doing about 70-hour weeks. But this is just something I've come to believe in, and I do it as I can, when I can.
That's great.
So,
that's
okay, you can, nice to have me, and if you have any more questions about anything, give me a holler.
And that was Oliver Porter talking to us. Thanks to Alexander Cosma for helping me with this podcast, and thanks to Oliver Porter. Check us out on Twitter and Facebook and seasteading.org, and let us know what you'd like to see on a floating city at seasteading.org.